Just to warn you, I've not got like a computer in front of me or anything, so if I need any facts checking, yeah.
I can slightly Google stuff, though you will hear the sound of keyboard.
No worries. Yeah, I'm just saying, I'm literally...
Is that right?
Ooh,
bitch.
I said what?
We usually do when Shane's doing the quiz anyway.
I've lost like quite a few of the last ones. Really, because you're the one doing the quizzes, isn't it? Bastards.
Into Sheringham, and Solskjaer has done it!
Leicester City have won the Premier League.
Scholes against Emil Heskey, could it be five? Yes it is!
Frank De Boer, singing out Dennis Bergkamp. Oh, that's brilliant! Oh, that's wonderful! That is a magnificent goal!
Hello and welcome to the V2 Football Podcast. I am your host this week, Shane Lees, and joining me, I've got Anthony Kendrick.
Hello!
And Richard Hero Hudson.
Good evening.
Oh, it's like honey poured over thunder when he says it. Right. Sorry, I'm getting turned on. Right. Starting this week, we've obviously had the League Cup final is now confirmed. That's probably one of the biggest things that's happened this week. And we've got Man City versus Arsenal. Arsenal dumped Chelsea out of the Cup 2-1. Man City were, I think it was 3-2 overall, was it 4-3 for the open two legs against Bristol City?
3-2 in the game and 5-3 overall.
5-3. So Man City versus Arsenal, is that a final we're looking forward to?
I guess so, it's two of the top six, isn't it? I think any final between any of the top six is a decent final, and yeah, I'm sure on the day, I mean, we can diss the League Cup and say how the early rounds, no one cares, but come the final, you know, you'll see basically full strength sides or close to it. So, yeah, I'm sure it'll be a good day. Bristol City obviously deserve a lot of credit on the side, but yeah, I'm sure I'll be watching it on the day and enjoying it.
And I think, City obviously go into it as favourites, but Arsenal can show on their day that they can beat the bigger clubs.
I was going to say, Arsenal have a very good record in finals. Do we reckon they're one of the few teams that can beat City in a final?
Yeah, I think so. The money's got to be on City, but yeah, Arsenal could turn up and do it, especially with the... presumably, if Arsenal managed to get Aubameyang in the next few days, he would be eligible to play in it.
I mean, we've got plenty of other Arsenal news for all those Arsenal fans out there that listen to this. I'm pretty sure it's mostly Man United fans, but there's plenty more of that. The other sort of small thing that happened this week was Leeds United. They got themselves a new club crest. It's always a bit of a risky thing when clubs change their crest. I remember Everton did it a few years ago, people quite liked it. But then again, there's always quite a few bad ones, shall we say. What do we think of this new one?
Yorkshire White Power.
It's not great, is it?
It's like it was made on paint. It's dreadful.
It is interesting how like the fashion sort of changed. Like you say about Everton, Manchester City as well changed their crest this year, and it's sort of a more modern look. And I think the taste in like the fashion of the crest has changed quite significantly with online and stuff. So yeah, it probably does need changing, but they need something. But they can't go out next season with that crest, surely.
For those who haven't seen it, it's literally there's a blue banner at the top which says Leeds United in big bold print, and then there's a guy doing the semi-Roman salute across his heart as if he's just about to go and do the Nazi thing in the middle. Apparently, that's the Leeds salute. I hate to tell you, as Leeds fans, the Romans had it first, and then you don't really want to know who came up with it next after that. You're not in great company with that one. But it's not even that. I think that there's anything inherently
that as well.
Yeah, it's not. I don't feel like there's anything that much wrong with the actual image. It just looks terrible. It looks so amateur. It genuinely doesn't look like the club made it. It looks like a fan made it.
I think one of the concerns with it, like obviously, it's got the links towards fascism with it and the Nazi party, but the fact that it's all in white as well. I know that Leeds obviously play in white, but it looks a bit on the all white power, and then you make it all white as well.
Yeah, it's a big question. Couldn't they have just done the White Rose of Yorkshire?
Well, that used to be the badge in the 80s, and that was, you know, I'm a Man United fan. I'm not a big Leeds United fan as a result. But the old rose badge that they used to have when they won the title, that was a classy badge.
Yeah, it's a nice image. It has very nice historical connotations. I can't see why they didn't really go for something like that. Man City, when they did their badge, they said, right, we're going to modernise it by going backwards. We'll look at what our old badges were like and we'll go back to something more like that. I felt like that was the right idea because it's enough. You're paying homage to the fans, to the club's history, but you're still trying to make it look a bit new and modern. This one...
Yes, it's improved theirs. The one that they had before was an absolute joke because it had the European stars trying to represent like what Bayern Munich and other great European clubs have, showing off how many European titles they've won. And City hadn't won it.
I tell you what, if you're a Leeds fan, the good news is the club have confirmed they're going to be opening up the consultation again. Apparently they asked 10,000 fans. Seems they have now admitted that consultation didn't go deep enough, so they probably did not ask 10,000 fans.
They asked 10,000 fans within an hour of them launching it, they'd had 10,000 complaints.
Yeah, I think they probably not asked 10,000 fans, or maybe they had asked them in like a very cryptic tweet, and then had about four people reply, and one of them mentioned something about, I don't know, Hitler, and they went with it. But yeah, they're reopening that up, hopefully they can sort it out, because Leeds United are too big a club to look that shit.
I think, well, you get these Twitter things getting hijacked. It was like someone posted earlier today, the Crawley said, does anyone want a big transfer reveal this lunchtime? And the top result in a Twitter poll was, no, we don't.
Yeah, and, I saw that. It was correct, Sandra. Who wants to see a bit of transfer news? And the answer was, nah, you're right. That's hilarious.
The thing is, though, if it goes to a fan vote, like I remember Everton did it for their badge, but then you get you know, these jokers who get involved. It was like, I can't remember who it was, but some joker won Liverpool player. Was it Mario Balotelli or someone like that won Liverpool player of the season last year? Because a load of fans hijacked it, and you know, they need to be careful. I don't know if there's a way of doing it so people who go to the game vote on it or something like that, maybe. It would be nice to see.
City, a few years ago, asked their fans what they should name the new stand, and United fans got involved and said it should be named after Ian Bell, so it'd be the Bell End.
See, when you're asking fans to things, there's a little rule you should have, which is you ask them essentially, you ask them if something's crap, because they'll tell you if something's crap, but you don't ask for any input on anything else, because they will just take the piss. So, you know, when they're all saying, this is a crap badge, that's when you pay attention. You don't ask them to name a new stand or a boat or something, because then you get voting with boat face. People just like to make fun of things in real life. It's an unfortunate thing. But all right, that's enough on Leeds. That's probably the most we've ever talked about Leeds on the BT Football Podcast. We'll now talk about the thing I know you two definitely are going to want to talk about. That's Alexis Sanchez has moved to Man United. Henrik Mkhitaryan's gone the other way.
There's no
transfer fee involved. It is a straight swap. Of course, there's going to be massive amounts of wages. And everyone knows that Sanchez's agent was asking for a lot of money. And presumably Mkhitaryan's agent was asking for a lot of money. So the idea that this was a £0 transfer, that's just not true. But either way, it's essentially, for what we can look at it, it's Sanchez for Mkhitaryan. Man United fans, are you happy?
Very. Yes.
What? Why? Why are you happy?
Because we've got a world-class player.
I suppose the question is going to be, one, did you need him? And two, what does that mean for the other players who he was competing with?
Yes, I think we do need him. I think he offers different options going forward. I think he's going to be one of those players that can... United still draw too many games. And that's been the case for a few seasons now. We've not got as many of those players that can turn a 0-0 into a 1-0. And I think he's one of those type of players.
I think
where he'll play, it's like he's predominantly played on the left side. But you know, for years he was on the right side. He's a right-footed player. I can easily see him being either in the central or the right with Martial on the left. And either him or Lingard operating in the centre or the mid.
So for my money, you've got four players. Lukaku, Rashford, Martial and Lingard. You're dropping one of them. Who are you dropping?
Rashford at the moment.
I agree. On current form, it has to be Rashford. And I think to say you're dropping one of them, that's fine. But, you know, with the way it works at United, especially in the attacking positions, I mean, we've seen Martial get a run again. We saw Rashford get a run earlier in the season. And it's... it's constantly rotating, and with players coming in and out, I think you know, four into three positions. Well, it's effectively about six players into four positions, and I think it goes fine. And you know, you always make an attacking sub during a game, at least one attacking sub during a game. Yeah.
See, I'll give my perspective. I think this is a good transfer for United. They've signed a genuinely world-class player. There's no question about that. In fact, they've traded him out for a player who was a sub-player at best. That's very good business. The amount of money in the contract, yes, I think that's a bit questionable, and I don't like seeing those kinds of money bandied about in football. I think that's bad for the game overall. But I can look over that, and accepting he's a properly world-class player going to United. What I don't like, though, is that he's been signed onto a 4.5-year contract, so this isn't like they brought him in for a year or two. This isn't like Ibrahimovic. And you've got players like Martial and Rashford, who were on the cusp of the first team, and now it's probably going to be one of them, unless they decide Lingard, despite being your best player somehow this season, is getting kicked out. It's going to be one of Martial and Rashford. One of them's getting the boot. And if you're one of those two players, I think you're going to be thinking, right, so I can do as good as I've been doing these last few years. At what point do I actually get trusted enough to be in the first team? If it's Martial that gets dropped, he's made it clear he wants to be in the first team, and for my money, he's good enough to be in the first team. He's not going to hang around if he knows there's someone who, if he's being honest, is better than him, who's going to be starting more games, regardless if he's coming off a bench. He knows he's going to start in 98% of teams on this planet. And if you're Rashford, you're thinking, who wouldn't in the Premier League want to sign me? Who wouldn't want to give me a go? And who wouldn't I get more of a chance playing regularly? And that, for me, has got to worry me, because either you're losing one who is an outstanding prospect in Martial, or one of your own who is also an outstanding prospect in Rashford, realistically.
Yeah, but Rashford's got to look in the mirror, really, for why he would be the one that would be getting dropped. You start at the beginning of the season, and who would you have between Rashford and Lingard? You'd pick Rashford every day of the week. But Lingard's upped his game tenfold this season, and Rashford's stalled.
But is there not a case for giving the young players more of a chance?
But he's had plenty of chance. He's been in the first team more than Martial, but Martial, when he comes on off the bench, and the same with Lingard, they've made the most of their opportunities. Rashford has just not been that player this season.
Could I spin it around and put it another way? What if Sanchez is an option up front over instead of Lukaku, and you could have Martial, Lingard, and Rashford all behind Alexis Sanchez?
I think that's almost more ludicrous, considering the amount spent on Lukaku, say now your second choice.
I'm not saying he's second choice as such. I'm just saying it may be an option in some games that may happen.
Yeah, but then you've got one or two. I mean, let's be honest. Lukaku or Sanchez are not going to be happy to be rotation players, are they? They're, none of them's going to want to say, yeah, I'm on the bench in this game. They're, if they're not starting every single game, they're like, no, I'm not a first team player. Why am I here? Someone else will pay me as much money or more to go and be a first team player. But I'll put it another way. If, as a direct consequence of signing Sanchez, Rashford gets sold, would you be happy with that?
I wouldn't be. I'd be pretty angry, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but I don't think that would happen. I think in this modern day and age, like you put into that as well, you've got Mata as well. You've got so then you've got six players jostling for four or five roles on the pitch. You're only still then missing out one every three games.
Okay, I'll put it another way then. As both Man United fans and England fans, are you happy that one of England's brightest prospects is quite likely to be relegated to little more than an impact player on the bench? And that's likely to be the case for at least 3 years, because Sanchez isn't going to get any worse in 3 years.
Boy's been replaced by another England player at the moment who's playing better than him, in Lingard.
Okay, here's another thing I'll make, because Man United are constantly being linked with big players, and of course that's the nature of Man United. Lazy journalists just like to make stuff up because they get bored and can't think of anything else. But I see it as being incredibly realistic. Within the next 2-3 years, United signs somebody like a Griezmann. The thing with someone like Lingard is, I don't think there's ever an amount of good he can do where he will not be being looked at to be replaced by someone who is, on paper, better. I think he could maintain his current form for the rest of the season and still look at replacing him at the end of it, or getting in someone, in quotation marks, better on paper.
If Lingard was taken out of the team on current form, then I would be furious as a United fan. I'd be absolutely furious.
Oh, same. As an England fan, same. He's on fire.
Yeah, it's difficult because Mourinho as well, he's hardly got the best track record of developing players. And I don't know. you can imagine, you can just see if Rashford goes, it'd be like De Bruyne with Chelsea, wouldn't it? It would come back and bite us.
I guess the thread I'm pulling at Central is, do you worry United that the young players are not being given enough chance to prove themselves? But more than that, even if they do prove themselves, there's still going to be that impetus to buy the big name player. It's almost like a Real Madrid tactic. If you bring in the big name player, and even if one of these players has been in great form, they're going to get replaced. They're going to get replaced because they're not big enough, they're not trusted enough to be in the first. Do you worry about this transfer, and I'd also say the Ibrahimovic transfer before, is kind of a signal of that direction? And do you, if it is that direction, are you happy or unhappy about that?
I'd prefer some faith in youth, but obviously, to put it another way, had this opportunity to sign Sanchez and we passed it up, then we'd be criticising the club. We'd look like fools. I hope young players get a chance. And, you know, I've gone on record on this podcast many times for saying I had so much respect for Louis van Gaal for his trust in young players. I really do. I genuinely hope Rashford and etc. get games. It's difficult because it's not happened yet. I personally think at the current state, it'll be okay with the rotation. I hope I'm right in that. But, you know, if say Griezmann or someone like that comes in the summer, then I'd be genuinely worried.
I think you've got to look at where United are now to where they've been in the last 4 or 5 seasons since Fergie went. And they're probably in the best state that they've been in since Fergie left now.
But is that state being built long-term with players like Ibrahimovic and Sanchez being signed? Especially if it's overlooking the young talent that could be the future.
I'd like them to be building more in how City are doing, and City are going for the 20-year-olds and putting them into the team rather than the 29. But United have, you know, the ability to constantly buy an £80 million player every summer.
But is that good, I suppose, is the key point. Is that something you're happy with as a United fan, or is it a case of if they win, then all right, the ends justify the means?
Yeah, it's not my money. They make the money. they bring enough money in to do it. It's a formula that works for Real Madrid and PSG and Barcelona and Bayern Munich.
All right.
To your nearest opponents. And it's off your nearest
That was gonna be what my next question was. Was this signing primarily done, do you think, to A, weaken Arsenal, but two, deny City a very talented player?
That was definitely an aspect of that.
Yeah, because obviously Mourinho's got a bit of a track record for it. He'd signed Willian for Chelsea to stop Tottenham from getting him. Of course, Willian turned out to be a class player, so that worked out pretty well. But everyone knew it was because he was going to be signing for Tottenham. Do we think that beyond all the other reasons we've just gone over, that was probably the main bit of thinking there?
I don't think with Arsenal, I don't think it was to weaken Arsenal, but certainly the fact that Manchester City were interested in him was, I'm sure, a factor. It kind of reminds me of like the Van Persie or the Berbatov transfers. I think City being interested was certainly a factor, and I think that was almost the convincer to sign Sanchez for me.
There's another player at the moment that both clubs are apparently trying to get in this January, and the Nice player John Magalseri. And I could see United stealing him from under City's nose as well.
That's a player we don't need, though. I can't see the logic in signing Seri.
I think we need another midfielder. I think with Carrick retiring at the end of the season, Fellaini probably going, Mata possibly going as well.
Does Tomine not deserve a chance? I don't think he's ever let the side down when he's been involved.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Scott McTominay. You know, there's another young player who's not getting a chance under Mourinho. Well, he's had a couple of games, but yeah, if we sign Seri, then there's, you know, Shane's point. Rashford's gone, McTominay looks a good prospect, he's then gone.
It's a big risk to say, yeah, let's... And I think you're being a bit tight on Mourinho. It's like, you wouldn't know about him unless Mourinho had been playing him.
But then isn't it more important how that actually works out in the end rather than how it starts? Because, I mean, Federico Macheda looked pretty good when he started and that all petered the hell out. Isn't it more important that he gets developed into a player rather than, oh, well, he started him, but all right, we're signing someone better now, so screw him, he's going to Fulham.
Yeah, that's the bit. It's like, Macheda got the chances, and then it turned out, after the two wonder goals he got in his first two games, he was actually pretty gash.
Yeah, but McTominay's not been gash, he's been decent. That's what
isn't it also...
Say.
Isn't it equally a risk to sign a player from another league who's never played in the English Premier Division and you don't know how good they actually are? Isn't that a risk too? We've spent far too much time on United. Let's talk a little bit about Arsenal. Mkhitaryan, good signing for Arsenal or not?
Yeah, I think he is. When you consider Sanchez was, well, more than likely going, they basically got him. It's a good deal for Arsenal. I think he'll fit into the Arsenal style a lot better than at United. And Mkhitaryan and Ozil behind a striker, I think, could be a very, very potent attack.
Yeah, from the situation in the end, it's better than nothing, which they were going to end up with. If they also do get Aubameyang, which is looking increasingly likely, then you're reuniting a pairing that absolutely stormed it in the German league.
Okay, all right. Well, in that case, it could be quite a good deal for Arsenal, it turns out. Probably slightly weaker, but then again, they've got some other good players who are now looking quite good. They don't actually look like it's going to be a massive impact. I feel like they've maybe phased Sanchez out quite well. I'm not sure yet. Other transfer news. This is, of course, a big one. Aaron Lennon has gone to Burnley. Any particular thoughts about that, or are we quite content with that one?
Yeah. I just hope he gets back some of the old form, really, and he's got over some of the clear off the pitch troubles he'd had.
Yeah, you just want to see him play with a smile on his face, don't you? After that, photo we saw him getting unveiled at Everton. I don't know if he looked any happier when he's unveiling at Burnley or not.
The other one, there's been two probably other big transfer stories this week. Brighton have signed a striker. They've broken their own transfer record to sign Jurgen Lokadia. He is a Dutch striker. He's been playing in the Dutch league. He's been quite good in the Dutch league for the last few years. If you're a Football Manager fan or a FIFA fan, you've probably known about him because he's been one of those ones of good potential. What do we reckon about that for a signing? Do you reckon that can be the thing that can keep Brighton up, that can be a good signing for the Premier League, or is that likely to be another Dutch flop?
He was on the podcast last week. We were discussing what did Brighton need, and people were saying they need defence and stuff, and they were saying, they've actually got one of the better defences in the Premier League. They've got one of the worst strike forces. So I don't know if Brighton were listening in because they've gone out and bought a striker. I've had him in my FIFA team for this season, and he's been immense on that. So if he's anything like that in real life, I think he's done well over for PSV though. Dutch league can be 50-50. Get next Suarez. Get next Alfonso on Alves.
Yeah, it is. He's very good on FIFA, as Hero says. It's one of them. I wouldn't like to say it will be one. It won't be an in between. He'll either be fantastic or dross. I wouldn't like to call it either way. So I'm going to bottle the calling it.
Yeah, I mean, if games are anything to go by, then Daniel Sturridge would make a great addition to the German First Division. I signed him for Dynamo Dresden out there, and he scored 36 goals. Managed to keep injury free all season. Talking about other strikers and clubs breaking their transfer record, we've got at Southampton, we've finally done something. Not the thing I was particularly hoping on, but we signed Guido Carrillo. Don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Carrillo.
We signed him from AS Monaco for 19 million. That's our transfer record broken. He is a striker whose goals to game record is pretty damn shocking for a striker. He's played 93 games in the French league, and in that time he scored 18 goals.
Not how many really. Starts?
I don't have a clue. Wikipedia does not have that much information.
He won't have many starts because Falcao's obviously the main man. You had Mbappe and others. He won't have many starts, to be fair. But yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if he's any better. What do you make of like Gabby Adini and Austin and Shane Long and the other strikers?
Well, my view is Gabby Adini. I don't know if he lost his puppy or something, but it was there was a point near the end of last year where he was just shocking, and he has been incapable of regaining any kind of form since then. He's been terrible, and I can't explain it because we know he's a good player, but he's been absolutely terrible. I don't know what it is. Maybe he's just not settled properly. Maybe it was a good start, and then when he actually lived in Southampton for too long, he realised he didn't like it. I don't know, but that has not worked out, and I think the sooner we get rid of him, probably the better. It's clearly not working out for both parties. Charlie Austin's a great striker. I'm happy to have him at the club. Problem is, he's too injury-prone. get him for five games and he scores six goals, and it's like, great. Then he's out for 10 games, we get him back for five games, and he still finishes club top scorer. But it's not really enough to get us through a season, not in a considerable way. Shane Long steals a living, frankly. I like Shane Long. He is a hard-working player. You can't fault him for that. He is a good option off the bench. He just doesn't score. I think he scored the other week, and that was like his first goal in about 32 games, which for a striker is pretty disappointing, to be honest. The only other one I was shocked about, I'm pretty sure I said this at the start of the year on the podcast, is that we let Sam Gallagher go out on loan, who looked like a very, very promising striker. As far as I was concerned, he should be getting involved in the first team this year, but we let him go, and now we've signed another striker in Carrillo, who, I don't know, maybe it's going to turn out to be one of the Southampton signings where it's like, oh my God, how did no one else know about this player? Hopefully it's one of those ones. Equally, this could be a bit of our, I don't even remember his name, the Norwegian centre-back we signed years ago, who played two games and we sold back to his original club at a loss. Can't even remember what he was just called. Begard Foran, there we go, he was shocking.
I've just had a look at your new striker's record this season, and it's very much the case for Monaco that he's getting off the bench, but it's for like 5 minutes and such. So all them appearances are a bit deceiving on his ratio. For the games where he's played 45 minutes or more, he's played 8 games of where he's only had 45 minutes or more this season. He scored 8 goals in them 8 games.
Well, I mean, yeah, maybe it could be a steal, and if it is, I'm going to be delighted, because what we really do need is a striker. For me, the only thing that I'm worried about is we sign this guy and we don't sell Gabbiadini in January or in the summer, and we've just put Sam Gallagher even further down the pecking order, and I think he is one of those ones, if we sold him, we'd look back at him 3 years and go, what the hell were we thinking? Now he's banging in, you know, 20 goals in the Championship or 15 in the Premier League for a team like Watford, and we're going, how on earth didn't we see that? So that's probably my only real concern, other than the fact we might have wasted £19 million on a bit part player who isn't very good. But yeah, I've probably spoken a bit too much about Southampton there. The other big signing is Joel Mario, who has gone to West Ham. He's a midfield player, and he is generally regarded to be a pretty good player. He's come from Inter Milan. He went to Inter Milan in 2016. He got signed for £35 million from Sporting Lisbon. It's basically been out of them because of the injuries they've got. They've had injuries to Lanzini, which I think he's had for quite a long time. And on our touch, he's been on fire this season. He's injured as well. He's not really done it at Inter Milan, but could this be a move that regenerates him? Hero, you probably know more about this player than me.
Yeah, he's a decent player. Before he moved to Inter Milan, he was quite heavily linked with a move to Man United. He's a strong player. I'm surprised the likes of West Ham have managed to acquire him.
Mm. He's very energetic. I think he'll be well suited to the Premier League. I watched him play internationally as well, and he's a very energetic sort of player. I think he'll suit the Premier League. I think he'll be a very good signing.
Well, I mean, David Moyes has done a hell of a job turning West Ham around. I mean, for all the mocking we gave him when he first went there, he's getting them out of the relegation zone. He's looking like he can turn them back into being a mid-table side, whether or not it's any more than that. Is, of course, yet to be seen, but turned around a club that was really sinking quite quickly, and they could not afford relegation. So maybe this could be a Moyes wonderstroke. Who knows?
It's good to see him. Just with Moyes, I just want to say it's good to see him on Match of the Day and stuff. He looks a lot younger, a lot happier, and it just fills me with happiness just to see how well he looks compared to when he was at United.
Yeah, the United time for him was a bit like, if you look at pre-presidency Obama and post-presidency, in like 8 years, he aged 40 years. And that kind of happened to Moyes in 1 year, so I'm pretty sure that means that the pressure at United is higher than the pressure of being the President of the United States. we'll go back to Arsenal news. Now, they have had another bid rejected for Aubameyang. Is he what they need, and do we think they can actually get him?
I'm not sure Aubameyang and Lacazette are what a partnership. I'm a bit confused. Aubameyang's a better striker, I think, probably, than Lacazette, but they're just so similar. I don't understand the logic, personally. Had they not signed Lacazette, I'd have said, yeah, they should be going all out for Aubameyang, but I'm not so sure.
I don't know if he's... Like, he bought Lacazette in the summer, and he's just not sort of cemented his role for Arsenal. I don't know if they're already thinking of, we're going to perhaps move him on already.
But he's hardly had a fair crack, has he? It's not like he's been It's not like Morata or Lukaku, who we compared them to because of their summer moves. He's not had a, you know, he's rotated around. He's been in and out on the side with Sanchez sometimes playing up front.
What does that tell you?
He's not had the opportunity. He's not had a decent run of games.
Yeah, you not compare him to Mkhitaryan?
That Wenger's already not really that set on him.
Could we not make the comparison to Mkhitaryan not getting games for United and then being booted out?
Yeah.
No, because Mkhitaryan's had a season and a half and he's not... He's had a few good games, but not he's not done it consistently enough. But Mkhitaryan has been in the side for a few spells. Lacazette hasn't really.
I tell you what, the thing that I look at this transfer, and it's not that Arsenal don't need a striker. I mean, admittedly, Giroud, whenever he plays, seems to score goals, which I don't understand why he doesn't play more. Lacazette, yeah, maybe he's not showing it now, but that could just be a confidence thing. And again, Danny Welbeck is a player who, yeah, obviously he's not the best in the world, but he does seem to perform. He's injury prone, I get that, but he performs when he plays. So I can't really understand that. And the thing that really worries me is, you know, I said quite early, I think it was near the start of the transfer window, big problem with this transfer window for clubs, you know, who aren't the likes of Man United and City is any big player they want to go for, everyone else will be going for too. I've got to wonder why no one else is going for Aubameyang. That's got to tell you something, why no one else is taking that shot on him. Because he's not like he's a Premier League player who, you know, people are worried, where is he going to go to a different league and do it there? He's an international player. Why is no other club in the world, knowing that he's available, and knowing he's available for a fairly competitive price in this market, why is no one else taking a chance?
I genuinely thought he'd end up at Real Madrid myself. But, yeah, no, you're right.
It's happened with Real Madrid, because they were clearly interested in him for a while. And they need a striker. They need to do something with their strike force. But I don't know if something with Aubameyang's character, I know he's been dropped, is it two or three times now by Dortmund for his behaviour?
Mm-hmm. But couldn't you also justify that behaviour as him trying to get a move away?
Wait. Oh yeah, clearly it is, but you still got to, as a club, look at that and think, you know, he's clearly a bit of a temperamental player. Do we want that on our books?
The other thing to point out is that there was interest from China as well. Is he more interested rather than joining Arsenal? Because some people would say, you know, is he more interested in earning £500,000, £1 million a week at some Chinese club? Because, you know, to some players, to some, well, general people, they'd rather do that than, say, £150,000 at Arsenal or whatever they're offering.
Okay, well,
you
know,
has that turned his head a bit?
If you're Arsenal and you're not going to be able to compete with the likes of United, Chelsea, City, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, for a world-class player, but one comes available and nobody else is going in for him, then whatever you've already got in that position, you still go for them.
Yeah, I suppose that's the point. Strike while the iron's hot. All right, we'll move on to other transfers that could happen. The big one that's looking like it's very likely to go through at the moment is Man City signing out Aymeric Laporte. Now, he's a French player who I think he's grown up in Basque Spain. He's a French national, though. He's always been at Atletico Bilbao. I'm not completely certain about, but I'm pretty certain he's come through their academy there. He's very highly regarded. He's regarded as being quite a good technical centre-back. Is this finally the centre-back they can sign that actually sorts out that centre-back pairing, that back three, whatever they're going to go with City? Is this finally the one that can do it?
Well, you said before about United getting in Sanchez and that knocks Rashford or Lingard down the pecking order. Does this not do the same with City and John Stones?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is kind of pointedly ludicrous. Otamendi's one of the best centre-backs in the league, if not the world at this point. And John Stones is one of the most highly rated young centre-backs in the world. And whenever he plays, he doesn't exactly look bad at the moment. I can't understand why they're in for him. The only thing I can think is maybe they're going to go for a back three. In which case, it does make sense there, but... if it's a back two, who gets dropped?
I can understand it in the, like, after Stones and Otamendi, you've got Vincent Kompany, who is on the treatment table more than he's playing nowadays, and you've got Mangala, who you just need to get out of the club as quickly as possible. So you do need cover. Million cover is a lot.
I'm not sure it's cover. I mean, we touched on it last week with Johnny Evans potentially going to the club, and said the same thing about United. I mean, look at United, for instance, at centre-back. They've got Bailly, they've got Rojo, they've got Smalling, they've got Jones. I think three centre-backs, you know, between the three, you know, you play 60, 70 games a season. If you've got them three centre-backs sharing the games between them, that's plenty of games to go around. And I think they can't depend on Kompany, and yeah, obviously Mangala will. They'll probably get shot of him in the summer, if not in January. So I don't know. I think he's obviously a decent player, and yeah, I think City probably do need a centre back.
I mean, I think he's clearly a good player. He comes with a good pedigree, and he comes from a club that consistently produces very good talent. The thing I worry about is the same situation at United with them signing Sanchez. Does this force a good young English player onto the bench? Because even if they say, oh, it's rotation and all of that lot, there's a first choice and there's a second choice. And in my mind, the way you run a football club is your second choice players are either your young players who have yet to break into the first team and you're now slowly introducing them via the bench, or they're players you have signed specifically for the bench. They didn't sign John Stones for the bench. They didn't sign Otamendi for the bench. £57 million, they're not signing Laporte for the bench. It's three centre-backs for two centre-backs positions, none of them being bench players, every one of them being told you're a first choice when they're signing them. And big players do not like not being known as the first team player. They'll leave. They'll throw their toys at the pram and they'll get out of that club. That's what they do. If you even a player like Mangala, yeah, he might be a bit rubbish. He has his moments where he's quite good, but he knows he's a bench player and he's clearly quite comfortable being a bench player. He's not kicking up any big fuss about being on the bench. In my mind, that's kind of a perfect situation. You know he's not good enough to be in the first team, but by merit of that, he's not going to be pushing too hard to get into the first team, meaning you don't have the issue of you have to drop one of your first team players who's going to be on more money and has a bigger ego. That's the thing I think, and I look at this transfer and think, as much as it is a good transfer, in the same way I look at the Sanchez one, I think it's not really the one they needed.
But to put as a parallel, I can't name you Manchester United's best two centre-backs. The same thing with Liverpool. Well, granted, Liverpool haven't got many good defenders, but, Liverpool, Van Dijk, obviously, but beyond that, who's their best two centre-backs? And Arsenal, all the big sides, you don't have a best 11 anymore. I think you need a best, a very good 18 players or something who are all first team. And I think this is where the problem is. And, with Sanchez, I think because football is such a squad game these days, I think City need three first team, first choice centre-backs effectively.
I will agree with you, in essence, it's become more of a squad game. But all those clubs you've just mentioned, when you look at those two centre-backs, here's how it actually is. Well, the three centre-backs. One of them's injury-prone, one of them's old, one of them's the one who consistently plays. So if they've got two who are fairly young and not injury-prone, then both of them play, right? They consistently play. If Phil Jones has been in fantastic form for Man United for the last year or so, if he's fully fit and Eric Bailly's fully fit, they start every game, don't they? Realistically, they start every game, yeah?
No, I wouldn't agree with that. I think sometimes Smalling would start. I think sometimes,
Maybe a cup game, but who wants to be a cup player? Not if you're 19, you want to be a cup player. If you're 27, you don't want to be a cup player, not when you're playing for these clubs. And here's the thing. Laporte, Otamendi, Stones, none of them are known for getting injuries. They're all in primes of their careers. And they're all good enough to be starting. So that's not the situation of one old, one injury prone, and one in their prime is the one who always plays. This is now three players who should all be playing every single game. If they're fit. If they're, in enough fitness to play. Right? That's different.
Okay. City, for me, should be signing a player who can get into the first team rather than signing a player who's not as good and will always be the backup. Always be the backup to those two for me. Anyway, I don't know. Maybe it's just different. It's probably different thinking on how you have your squad. But I think it keeps the team more competitive. And I'd
be Anthony on this one.
I mean, I can understand that position.
You look at what Chelsea did in the summer, and they bought squad players to fill in roles when players got injured. And look how it's turned out for them this summer, this season. They didn't buy players that were challenging for the first team.
Yeah, now they're competing for second spot with United. It's not sure if that is the best example. Well, they're doing quite well.
Because last season they bought the league, and now they're a distant third.
If Chelsea were playing as good as they were last season, they would still be behind City. City are just utterly exceptional.
Chelsea got extremely lucky with injuries, etc. last season. Chelsea had a lucky year, but, that's a different debate.
Yeah, because Chelsea had a very strong first team and not anyone challenging those players for their roles. Yeah. And so what did they do? They bought squad players, and now when players have got injuries or they're not performing, they're having to now replace them with weaker players. They can't.
Right.
They're taking out a first team player and replacing him with someone that is good enough for a hole.
If a team makes the knockout stage of the Champions League and has a decent cup run, that's easily 60 games a season, and yeah, you know, that's what, 120 games, 120 centre-backs, no, that's 40 games each for your three centre-backs. I don't know. To me, that's logical, but, yeah.
I'm of the position you always leave a slot open for the young players. That's my perspective. There should always be
If City have three very good centre-backs, make the fourth one an academy graduate, that's the way. You have Kompany and then an academy graduate as your centre-back choices. That's the way to do it for me.
I mean, from my opinion is basically the same as yours, but the third one is your academy graduate, like Adara Bioyo for City or Jack Stevens for us, who's now moved into the first team. But alright, yeah, it's a very minor difference, it turns out.
You're living in a rosy-tinted world where that just doesn't happen anymore.
I like my rosy-tinted world. It's nicer than the real one. Right, well, we'll go on to Chelsea.
United teams of yesteryear, where you had four players rotating round for striker roles, and the 99 team that had Sheringham, York, Cole and Solskjaer as options up front.
For some reason, when you paused, I thought you were going to say 99 problems, but a striker ain't one. I just had that in my head.
And then the same goes to the team that won in Moscow when you had Ronaldo, Rooney, Berbatov and Tevez.
Berbatov not even on the bench.
Quality.
Well, maybe I'm just a small club fan. We do things differently in the shit league. We'll go back to Chelsea because Chelsea we kind of got onto it a little bit. Here's something I genuinely cannot understand. You've got Marcus Alonso, who has been, for the last year or so, one of the best left-backs, in my opinion, in the world. This season, right. He's maybe not has been as good as he was last season, but then again, no Chelsea player has. But he still is one of your consistently most high-performing players. You just have to look at the fantasy points to realise that one. He's ironically one of Chelsea's top scorers as a left-back. Gets tons of assists. He is one of the most defensively solid players they have, one of the most convincing in the air. Why then are they seemingly so obsessed with replacing him? Because they were linked with Alexandro for ages. Now it looks like they're getting the fairly young Emerson Palmieri from Roma. Why are they so hard trying to change for one position where that's actually probably their strongest one? Could someone explain this one to me?
No, I'm very confused by it as well. Alonso's been amazing. He was obviously amazing last season. And you say he might have dropped a bit, but not for me. I think he's been just as good this season. You know, the Chelsea squad is pretty thin, is an argument you could make. Kennedy's that option as a wide man, but he doesn't look good enough. Perhaps bringing in a fullback, but then they brought in Zappa Costa in the summer, and he's done nothing, because Victor Moses generally gets the start. So, yeah, if he replaces Alonso as first choice left back, it's an absolute joke, but... You know, again, going back to my earlier point, football is a squad game, and Chelsea do need probably another fullback, and they need to rotate the squad better.
We do know how it goes at Chelsea, though. They sign a player who's better than the one they've currently got, or as good. It doesn't mean they rotate. It means they sell him. It means they sell the one they just had. That's how it always works at Chelsea. They don't do squad depth.
We'd love him. Look at Batshuayi. He's stagnated because Chelsea haven't rotated their squad properly and given him a game. If Marcus Alonso's for sale, we'll gladly take him at Man United.
You bloody would. But Batshuayi is a perfect example. He's a player who is, in my opinion, probably actually good enough to play for Chelsea as a first-team regular. Because as much as he might not have the on-paper ability, he does actually quite consistently do it when he does play. But now they're trying to sign all these other random strikers. Edin Dzeko, they've been quite heavily linked with at the moment. They've been seemingly trying to sign anyone English over 6'2". And it's quite apparent now they want to sell Batshuayi. As I said, they don't do squad depth. They do the system almost I like, which is you have your starting player and you have your backup, who's either a young player, which of course Chelsea don't actually do, or someone who is known to be a rotational player. But I just can't really understand what they're doing, because they've got Morata and now they're signing Dzeko. Dzeko's a very good player, but wouldn't you just give Morata more of a chance? He's clearly good enough. He's just clearly lacking confidence.
Yeah, for me, especially in the striker positions, I'd like to have two options. You've got Morata as sort of your target man. Dzeko's also a target man sort of player. For me, a player like Batshuayi is your perfect second option because he's something different. He's a player who's, fast, likes to get in behind, and he's, it's two different styles of striker. Yeah, I don't see why you'd have two of the same. It's like Aubameyang and Lacazette. I don't understand why you'd have two of the same style of striker.
Completely agree with you on that one. Chelsea's transfer business, what they've been trying to do, I can almost understand what kind of approach they're going for, which is we don't upset the current good bunch we have, but we bring in players who can just fill in the bits where if we did get injury problems, it would be a problem. But the execution of it seems to just be, and there's only one word that can describe it, mental. It's crazy. There's no consistency whatsoever with what they're doing. And I can't understand this for a club that has, admittedly, it's being run by someone who probably could have us all killed. But it's been run pretty well over the years. That we might not agree with the model they do. I certainly don't, especially the young players. But it does work for them. How have they seemingly gone so crazy within a year?
Well, I said this last week on the podcast, that they seem to have peaks and troughs. Every year after Chelsea win the title, they just go off the rails season after. Both transfer-wise and on the pitch. It seems that Ibrahimovic gives up a bit, and so do the players. And then the year afterwards, they start rediscovering the passion again.
Can you imagine if, big companies did this? Well, Apple, we've had a really good year this year. Let's just make the crappiest thing we can next year, and let's just do a whole slipshod. Can you imagine if big companies did things the way that Chelsea Football Club did?
With Apple, they just rinse and repeat every year.
Yeah, we've been developing all this really good young talent. Let's say we've been making all these really good software developers. They know a thing in and out. Great, let's get rid of them. Let's find some old fogies from Android.
I really hope Dzeko is the next Batshuayi, though, in all seriousness. I sold him on the manager game on the forum today, so it's one of them. I could look like a donut if he replaces Morata and he scores 50 goals before the summer, which might happen, though, in my luck, but hopefully he's like Batshuayi and doesn't play a single game, scores about one goal.
We'll move on from transfer news. I think we've covered all of that quite well. We've got a few more other pieces to do. I'm going to start off with probably the one that's going to be more of a talking point. Man United fans, again, going back to you lot as much as you love it. Jose Mourinho has signed a new contract till 2020. I think that is a one-year contract extension.
And we've got an option till 21. Yeah,
there's another option as well to extend the contract. As United fans, are you happy with that, or were you kind of hoping at the end of his contract it would have been an opportunity to, having had Mourinho steady the ship, bring someone in who could be a bit more long-term?
Go on, Hero.
I'm very happy with it. The reason being, firstly, I don't think there's many better managers out there. I don't think there's many better managers that can attract world-class players to the club. I think there's only Pep that's probably above that in the world. And I think he was clearly being sounded out by PSG, I think, in the last... Either his agent was sort of making a point of it to try and get the contract sorted, or PSG were clearly having a sniff around him. Because he's re-signed, that says to me that United have said to him, yeah, we're going to back you 100%. And that, I like the sound of, because it means that in the summer, they're going to go all guns blazing again and be challenging City for the top players. They have to keep up with City. Well, not just keep up with City, they have to go bigger than City.
Rashford and Lingard really are buggered, aren't they?
I was going to say that. I am very concerned for some of the young players because, Mourinho's not improved anyone, and I'm very... Rashford in particular is one. I fear he won't make it at United. Mourinho does not have a good track record, improving players. Players like Rashford, like Lingard, our other young players like McTominay and the various others, they'd be better. They'd be doing a lot better for us and for England over at say City, for instance, or even with Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool, perhaps. And it's very disappointing. I'm no Mourinho fan, I've said it for a while, but I'm not particularly. I'm not delighted he's signed a new contract. I'd almost prefer it if he'd signed, say, an 8-year contract or something, and he was saying, right, we're going to do 8 years, we've got an 8-year plan, we're really going to develop the youth, something like that. But no, I don't see that with him, and it is disappointing.
Is your worry then that it's sort of an extension of the short-term thinking?
Yeah, definitely. Nail on the head, yeah.
I mean, welcome to the rosy-tinted spectacle section, Anthony. You're in good company here, supporting the young players. It's nice here, isn't it? It feels quite good.
It is.
You just know it's not going to work out for you.
No, it's 2018, Colin.
Genuinely, but it really, really upsets me seeing Mourinho. I went to watch the United under-21s a couple of weeks ago, and I was depressed watching it, because I just saw, like, I was watching them and thinking, these kids have got no future at United. It's so sad to watch them play and try so hard.
Jeez, and never go to, like, a subpar African country and see the kids there. You will just properly weep about their futures.
Get some sort of, like, fundraising going and sing a song for them.
Sorry, all of our African listeners, I didn't mean to disparage your entire continent there. There are plenty of good African places.
Are you going to diss Japan next? That's where most of our listeners come from.
I have got an African family. I am not a racist. That's true, actually. Right, okay, we'll move on to other news before we put ourselves into a real corner. Harry Kane has been voted the England's Men's Player of the Year for 2017. Mm-hmm. Anyone who could have realistically challenged him for that one?
No, not anyone. Lallana, maybe, I don't know. But no. I'm trying to think. Okay, who would you name as the second best? I can't think of anyone. It's obviously the right decision. I'm trying to think who you'd name as second place, and I'd probably say Lallana, but, you know,
I'd maybe go second place, maybe someone like Phil Jones.
I
think this is all a very distant second place.
Of course it is. I'm just trying to think if there was any alternative. I think
Raheem Sterling.
He's probably another
for England one. Though. Has he done much for England? For City, he's been out. Yeah, for City, he's been outstanding. But has he done anything, you know, special for England? I can't think of anything. Perhaps because there's not been many memorable England games. Obviously, there wasn't a tournament or anything, but. I don't know. The only other thing I could think of is could they have given it to like an under 21 player as a token, or you know, an under 20 player, sorry, as a token or something? I think
the thing they'll probably say is, you know, we had an under 21s award that went to Jordan Pickford, by the way. So you know, that's what that's for. I do agree that maybe they could have gone with the whole basis of our young players have performed tremendously well in international tournaments. Let's make sure we recognise that. But I can also equally agree Harry Kane has been the best English player for the last year, be it for the England team or be it for his club. There's really no real argument there from anyone. So
really, yeah, maybe sorry, like because he's retired and that, could they have given it him? Maybe, I don't know. I presume England player is based on their performances for the England national team.
I think so, but I cannot confirm that. We are really good at research here.
I'm pretty sure it is, but yeah, I don't know. That's the they could have maybe given it to Rooney as a nice token, but yeah, on actual merit, it can't not be Harry Kane.
Looking at Kane now, and he's in the top five players in the world at the moment.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And you know, when was the last England player to really be in there? Gerrard.
I'd have gone Lampard personally. I think Gerrard was a bit overrated. Well, then again, I'm probably in good
award wise, Gerrard got there, didn't he? I don't think Lampard got in that like top five, did he?
No, probably not. But I'll tell you what, we will move on because we're a bit short of time. We're going to move on to the Nations League draw. Okay, quick question. Does everyone here listening understand it?
Can you explain it for us? Just for the benefits of those listeners who don't understand it.
Okay, so we have four leagues within the Nations League. Within each of those four leagues are four groups. In the bottom group, you've got teams of four. In the rest of the groups, you have groups of three. Now, once we get past this, what happens is a simple promotion relegation. Teams play each other. Whoever ends up on the top goes into the A League. And those ones are the ones who compete to be top of that group. And then those in that group go on to a Final Four competition, which ends up being a cup final. There's also the plus side of the winners of the individual leagues and groups can have a chance to go and get qualification for the Euros as well. Now, that's mainly looking at the teams in the lower groups to give them a bit more of a chance of realistically getting to the Euros. I don't think they've actually got many spots. I can't remember off the top of my head how many spots they get, but I know it's not that many. It's probably the most convoluted system anyone could come up with for something terribly simple, really.
Do you both watch Friends when that was on? And it's currently back up on Netflix and on any other channel as well.
Years and years ago, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember a game that Joey had to do called Bamboozled?
Yeah, where none of it makes any sense.
Yeah, that, I think that's what UEFA were playing when they came up with this format.
I don't think it's a bad idea when you go into it, though. Like, I think this is the sort of thing, because we've been taking the piss, especially in this country, of international friendlies for ages, and they've finally tried to make it mean something. You know, it might work. At least they've tried something different. You know, even if after, you know, 4 years of trying it, they say it don't work, fine, we can move on to something else. But I think even as a trial or something, I don't think it's a bad system, to be completely honest with you.
A load of friendlies that aren't, at the end of the day, they might not end up being friendlies.
Mm-hmm. But you've also got this problem of teams playing... like playing the system with these meaningless friendlies, you know, like I think Switzerland were a top World Cup seed because they played the system with the friendlies, and it kind of stops that as well.
They can play the system with the Nations League, they can deliberately get relegated into lower groups so they can top that lower group and then get a qualification to the Euros. So it can all be game. I personally do agree this is a good idea. It's just about as poorly executed as it could have been. One, it's so utterly confusing how it actually works for the layman. You generally have to sit down and actually read about how it works. A football tournament shouldn't be that. It should be teams play each other this amount of times, they win, they lose, then you go into knockout. That's international competition. That's all it should ever really be. And that's simple. Anyone can understand it. That's why football has become the most popular sport in the world. It's so incredibly easy to understand and pick up quickly. This is not easy to pick up. I think I know about it, and I'm probably wrong on a lot of things. But the big problem is it fundamentally failed at what it was trying to achieve. What it was trying to achieve was to replace friendlies so we can have competitive fixtures, so meaningful fixtures, filling in the spot between the Euro qualifying and the actual international tournaments themselves. Now, with the focus on that, the focus isn't on the little teams, it's on the big teams. Let's have the big teams have playing games, so they're going to be competitive in them. They're going to be trying to win because they want to win a competition, right? That makes sense to everyone. Now, the issue is that the big teams who are playing don't need to be playing really well to qualify for Europe, because they're probably going to have already done that with the groups anyway. And getting to a final, they don't know whether or not they really want to win it. Are they really going to try that hard? I don't think, because what are they going to do when someone's winning and, you know, the Nations League and lifting that trophy? Are they going to, you know, be properly going for it, shaking it above their head, screaming, all the fans going crazy? Or are they going to hold it up and go, yay, how significant is this, guys? Have we just won a big thing, or is this like, you know, not even the Europa? Is this the plate? Have we won the plate here? Because that's what it's going to feel like to the big team. It's a good idea for the smaller teams, and it gives them more of a chance to qualify. And I agree that the smaller teams are now good enough to justify places in the Euros, so I'm fine on that level. But that wasn't really the problem, because they were already starting to get to the Euros. The problem was
the Coca-Cola Cup for internationals.
Big nations
will just blood in the youngsters for it.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole point is to make the big teams more competitive again. Because the problem they had was the big teams were either playing the little teams or playing each other, but not playing full-strength teams. Stadiums weren't selling out. TV attendances were dropping. That was what they were focusing on. It wasn't about getting the little teams more prominence or getting them to Euros. That was the good side effect. The problem was the big teams. And this fundamentally doesn't solve it because, A, they don't have any impetus to, because it doesn't affect their qualification status. And B, they don't even know if they want to bloody win this thing yet. They don't know how significant it is. And you look at the actual reaction to this tournament, it's not been one of, oh God, I can't wait for this to actually finally happen. It's been like, oh right, we'll just see how this goes when we get there. It's not like the hype of any other tournament. So why are they going to really want to try that hard? So it hasn't solved the problem. I do think it is the right idea. Get rid of some of these meaningless friendlies and replace them with competitive matches. But for me, you've got to tie in some real impetus into it. In my opinion, if you're going to do this, scrap European qualifying. Scrap it. Get rid of it. Get rid of it for qualifying for the Euros. Replace it with a rolling tournament that goes on, and the winners of these tournaments are they're the ones who go and qualify. You combine it into one, you know, kind of bigger thing, and you proper see it out. So the big teams are consistently playing each other, meaning big teams might not make it to the Euros, but the smaller teams have also got a better chance. And now it really is actually bloody competitive, and the big teams are going to be having to go for it every single time. That seems to be the obvious solution to me. Might be undesirable because it upsets the status quite a little bit too much. But this current solution isn't actually a solution to the problem they were trying to solve. It solved something else that wasn't really a priority.
I don't know. I'd argue perhaps it is a priority in terms of TV attendances and, you know, stuff, because It is. It's appalling, and no one really wants to bid for the TV rights, and nobody really cares about the internationals. I mean, how many times do we want to watch England beat Estonia 3-0 in some meaningless qualifier that's the 8th of 10? I don't know. If we can get these games to be truly competitive with, you know, England v Spain, Germany, whoever the top seeds are, then it could be very good. I think, you know, we could look back at this and it could be very good.
The problem is it won't be competitive. It is basically a plate competition. It's a competition that is not as meaningful as the one they actually want to
could
win.
Could it end up like the Confederations Cup?
No, I don't think so, because the Confederations Cup is a genuinely recognised international tournament, and it's promoted as the build-up. It is the setting the stage for the big tournament, the World Cup. So it's got enough of a pedigree and enough of a history as well going behind it to kind of justify itself. The problem with this one is, A, the competition itself, nobody knows why they want to win it. They don't know how much it means to win it, and that's really going to take away from the drive to win it. But also, you combine it with the fact, okay, if we lose that, what about if we give them something else, qualifying? We give them qualifying so that they really want to go for events so they can qualify. But the big teams are already going to have qualified. They'll qualify through the Europa qualifying, which is, you know, what's going on beforehand. So they'll have qualified for it. Why do they have to try then? Why do they want to try? How about we actually drop down a group or two and we have some easier games so we're rested during the off-season? Wouldn't that make more sense in some of these clubs? It was a good idea. I just don't think they've done it in a way that actually solves any of the problems they wanted it to. Anything here?
I just want to know when they're going to play the Wicked Wango card.
All right, we'll move on to our last talking point. And I've had this written down by Chris, who normally hosts the show. Phil Neville is a dirty sexist. Disgust.
Disgust or disgust?
That was deliberate.
Or is it disgust as in it's been discussed?
Yeah, okay. So he has become manager of England's women's team. For those who don't know, for whatever reason he's decided to become England manager's team for the women's, or whatever reason anyone's decided to give him that job. Day one into it, and it's revealed he's had some messages that some might consider to be sexist on his Twitter. He's deleted his Twitter, and he's apologised for having ever made these comments. That's day one. So, I suppose there's a couple of issues. A, is he actually any kind of good enough for this kind of position? Or is this something that should have been going to someone who's established in the women's game or something like that? So is this almost like an accidental insult to England women's football when they're saying, right, you can have the guy, we're just kind of testing if he's even a good coach, let alone a good manager? And B, is this a lot of hubbub made out of absolutely nothing?
Right, the first question about is Phil Neville a good enough coach? From what I've read about it, the search for the next coach was very thorough. And he kind of ended up winning it by default. I believe six candidates got interviewed. One of them was the interim manager who didn't want the job. One of them said they didn't want the job for personal reasons. And three of them took other club roles, you know, moved clubs or something. Yeah. He was the sixth candidate that got interviewed, so he basically won by default.
You say
how many candidates were women?
Four or five. No, because the interim manager's a woman, and three of them, I'm sure, at least three were definitely women.
There's very few actual women managers in even the women's league.
The Manchester City manager, the top managers in the, you know, the women's Premier League equivalent, they all said that they prefer to stay with their clubs than move to England. I do genuinely think the FA have scoured, had a good, you know, have done their scouting properly, and that I think they genuinely have, and I think he's genuinely come out to be decided to be the best person for the role. It's very hard to judge, I know.
How can we say, with even a semblance of confidence, that they've been thorough about this? One, they've not even done the due diligence to realise to tell Neville to delete his bloody Twitter before he gets the job. They've not even checked that. I'm sorry, most normal companies will go through and check people's social media to see if they've actually, if they've actually, you know, a huge racist or something. That's a pretty standard practice. So they've not even done that due diligence. Also, we know the FA to be utterly farcical at the senior levels when it comes to these kinds of appointments. They appointed Sam Allardyce for one. Much as I was a big fan of Sam Allardyce, I still think he got a hard deal. They appointed him despite the fact they obviously knew what had happened with Sam Allardyce beforehand and after. So there's that. And there's the whole Aluko thing. There's the various catastrophes that Ashworth, Glenn and Clark have been overseeing. How can we honestly say, on any level, yeah, they've clearly done a thorough job here?
Because I don't see any. I'm not going to claim to be some expert at the women's game, but from what I've read about the genuine people, I don't see anyone suggesting a different person they should have brought. And it's easy to say, oh, it's wrong to have Phil Neville, but no one's making, apart from the interim manager, who didn't want the job and has gone down saying that, no one's really suggested a different name that should have got the job. They're just saying, oh, it's wrong that Phil Neville's got the job.
How about Carlo Ancelotti? He's available.
No, but he's not, obviously, you know, gone to the interview or whatever, or, you know, expressed an interest. I think it's,
He's not expressed interest. That's not a surprise.
I don't know what you want me to say, but I do think on a different note with Phil Neville, it will get some interest in women's football, I think.
Is it, though, the actual issue that they've come up with? And I don't have the tweets to hand. One of them was something along the lines of, he said, morning men, how are we all doing today? And then he had to back up by saying, sorry, I didn't say morning or women. I assumed you'd be taking the kids to school and that kind of thing. And the other one, a tweet which said, just battered the wife. That was sarcastic. He had not just battered his wife. If he had done, then the police would have come round shortly after that tweet. But has this all been blown massively out of proportion?
I think it has. I think obviously because of what occurred with the last England manager, and there's a clean-up in the whole of the world at the moment in regards to men's attitude towards women and such, and it's thoroughly deserved in many areas. But at the same time, perhaps sometimes it's going a bit too far the other way.
Yeah, I do agree. This is partly what's happened previously with the FA, with Samson and so forth. And this is also heavily linked with the current global movement to, I don't know how exactly to describe it, cut off men's penises, very, you know, to sort men out because we're evil and women are all victims. You probably can guess my politics on this one. But yeah, there's a bit of a global movement. This one just feels like it's a bit of a witch hunt style one where it's like we kind of need to look for anything to complain about with him. So we can really make our point that we don't want a man in charge of the England team. Which, my first point was, I kind of agree with that sentiment. I think they should have tried to have found a women's manager for the women's team. Now, if they couldn't have done that, if they did genuinely and were thoroughly looking, then fair enough, I can understand giving it to a coach like that, because a lot of the senior men's managers are not going to be interested in that kind of role, even though Neil Redfern did recently move to the women's league. But I feel like this is just a thing where it's like, did he really say anything that bad? It was clearly only ever made in like a comedic sense. And Jesus Christ, if that's the case, how the hell does Frankie Boyle ever get a job? Especially during the Guardian. Jesus Christ.
It's two different issues, isn't it? The first about is what Phil Neville said on Twitter acceptable. That's one argument. And I think, you know, obviously the other argument, should he be the England women's team manager on merit, or should they have picked a woman? It's two different arguments, two different strains of thought, and they're both being confused and intertwined. Which is wrong. I don't personally have an issue with what he said on Twitter. Perhaps not the best choice for England manager, I don't know. But probably is for me, but it's difficult to judge. But I think, yeah, it's two different strains of thought, and I don't want to turn this into a feminism and politics podcast, because we're talking football, and also I might get in trouble from women I know. I don't want to turn it into a feminism podcast, but...
Well, I tell you what, there is one valid point I saw someone else raise, and they basically said, if Gareth Southgate can get the England men's job, why on earth can't Phil Neville get the England women's job? Because Gareth Southgate's prior experience in football playing is basically the same as Neville's, and his management experience is incredibly limited and not particularly good. So why on earth can't Phil Neville get this job when he's had coaching experience in the likes of Valencia, and he's got a strong footballing career behind him? That I can understand as a point. I suppose it would have been preferable to get a women's coach for a women's game, but maybe it wasn't just an ideal situation, that one. But all right, I think we've probably covered off everything that's happened in the last week or so. I'm assuming no one else has got anything else to talk about?
Just the half an hour deleted scenes on talking about Phil Neville and feminism, but yeah, we'll save that.
All right, well, I'd say, well, thank you everyone for listening to this week's football podcast. You can find us on Facebook, you can find us on Twitter. Please check out the other shows we've got going. We've got the 72 show, and we've also got a wrestling podcast here on V2 now, apparently. I am not a fan, I don't listen to it myself. But yeah, please check out all our other stuff. Please check out our interviews. We've got some really good stuff out at the moment. And yeah, hopefully we will see you all again next week. Good night.
Good night.